There you go. It's on. Okay. You did it. Whatever you did. What'd you do?
I have no idea.
One of those things, huh? Okay, fine. Yeah, I can. I know this room real well, so no problem. Yeah.
Okay. So whenever... Okay. 1 minute.
Okay.
Just make sure your mic's on.
All right, folks, why don't we start? Can you hear me back there? Can you hear me back? Yes? Okay, good. Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody. It's our last repro lecture today, so let's finish it up. So we stopped, I think, on this slide yesterday, which was that moment post-fertilization when the two nuclei come together and fuse, right, and become a form a diploid nucleus, which then begins to lead to this first cell division, and then a second cell division, and a third cell division. So remember that the egg is a very large cell, right? And so also remember that fertilization occurred by the passage of that sperm via the acrosome reaction through the zona pellucida, right? It's binding to the surface of the oolemma, the internalization of the sperm head, and then the dissolution of the DNA into a pronucleus, fusion of pronuclei. But the zona pellucida is still there, okay? And so at this point, when the cell divides for the first time, and now what does the oocyte have to do? Well, the secondary oocyte has to finish up its second mitotic division, right, to form that female pronucleus, which it does. And now it's an ovum. It's fertilized. The two nuclei come together. Cell division begins. But so now we have one cell, then we have two cells, then we have four cells, eight cells, 16, and so on. And so all these divisions, which last about 5 days maybe, are still contained within the zona pellucida. So the egg does not really hatch, if you will, until it actually begins to implant in the uterine myometrium. So it takes several days to get down to the myometrium. And this slide nicely shows you kind of the early events that go on. And so here we have the fertilized egg. Notice there's two polar bodies now, because one polar body has been extruded in the first mitotic division, and the second one is extruded with a second mitotic division. And okay. And so now we have two cells, big cells, you know, four cells, still big cells, and so on. And so eventually we form this solid ball of cells. It looks like a soccer ball, but it's really a solid ball of cells. That's the ball of cells that we call the morula, M-O-R-U-L-A. The morula is composed of the totipotent stem cells. You can cut it in half. Each half will grow into a child. Okay, so it's a very resilient structure, and it's a very undifferentiated structure. And then around day four or so, day five, day six, somewhere in there, the morula begins to differentiate into the blastocyst, which is a fluid-filled sphere of cells, which has on its outside cells which are very powerful, very invasive, very endocrine-y. Okay? They can make a lot of hormones, very synthetic, just probably the most remarkable cells of all. And these are the so-called trophoblast cells. These are the cells that form the placenta. And inside that sphere, which is fluid-filled, the blastocyst, we have the inner cell mass, which is the clump of cells that will grow into the embryo. That's the term we use for about the first 9 weeks of pregnancy, because that's when all the organ systems are laid down. And after 9 weeks, we call it the fetus. And so the implantation site normally, hopefully, is in the uterus, as shown here. This would be a nice place to implant. The side wall of the uterus is just about the ideal place. And so here's an artist's rendition that's a little bit more beautiful maybe, but shows much the same thing. You can see the two-cell stage, the morula, the blastocyst, and now the implanting blastocyst, which has to find a place on the endometrium that it wants to implant. It then attaches through integrins and other molecules and begins to kind of burrow itself underneath the surface. So this is a morula. This is a slide you saw in the first lecture, maybe a four-day embryo. And so it's just a solid ball of cells. There's no embryo really yet. It's just a bunch of cells, okay? It's only when you get to the blastocyst that you can actually differentiate the embryonic cell versus the cell, the trophoblast cell, which is the cell that forms the placenta. So this is another drawing that shows you the process of implantation. Again, you can see here's day 6, day 7, day 9. Blastocyst approaches the endometrium. Here are those glands we talked about. And now there's an attachment and an internalization as differentiation is going on. So you can see here the first beginnings of differentiation in what's going to become the embryo. And so this is a drawing that's maybe less artistic, but it's fairly telling and accurate because it shows you the surface of the endometrium kind of bulging out a little bit. Here's the implanted mass. Here is the embryo forming. Here's the amniotic cavity forming. Here's the yolk sac forming. And here are those shoots of cells, which are the trophoblast cells, which kind of crawl out into the maternal endometrium and begin to seek out a way to establish the connection to the mother, because ultimately we're going to have a placenta, which is a chamber that blood flows through, that has to be done, created by the trophoblast cells. And so let's talk about what can happen early on. So one thing that can happen is if an egg is released and it's fertilized, and then as it's when it's a marula, let's say that the cement, you know, between those cells for some reason is weak, and maybe for some reason two cells break off, okay, and a little clump. So now we have the main clump, we have the two-cell clump, okay? Each of those will implant, form a blastocyst implant, and form an individual. And so that would be one example of identical twins. The other thing that can happen, which is really shown in the drawing at right, is that you can have the marula form, and then the blastocyst forms, and then you have the inner cell mass inside the blastocyst, and that inner cell mass divides into two clumps, you see? And so each of those will form an individual, but because they're still surrounded by the trophoblast cells, because that's the outside, right, of the blastocyst, those two children-to-be, okay, will have to share a placenta. You understand the distinction? So the marula divides into two pieces. Each fetus will have a placenta, and they'll implant different places and so on. Here, implantation will take in one place, will occur in one place, but the two fetuses will have to share one placenta. And so as it is, you know, with any of you who have siblings, it's rarely an equal relationship, is it? So in this case also, when it comes to twins, it's rarely an equal relationship in that one twin usually gets more of the blood from the placenta than the other one. And so in an extreme case, one of the twins may actually die. And that's called twin-twin transfusion syndrome. It doesn't happen often, but there's always the competition, even at that point, for nutrients. Because there's one placenta, two umbilical cords, and the flow in each of those umbilical cords may be different. So identical twins look the same. They're the same sex, right? They're genetically the same. These two old guys, obviously, are identical twins. Now, fraternal twins are essentially two siblings that are born at the same time. So they're no more similar than any brother and sister, 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 brother, brother might be. It's just that what happened is that there were probably two eggs ovulated, and they were fertilized by two sperm. They formed two blastocysts, and those two blastocysts implanted in two places. Each has its own placenta, and they may be different sex, and they may have be the same sex, different sex, but they'll be born about the same time. Is that clear? Okay. And so this was an old movie called Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, and the whole premise of the movie was that these guys were twins, fraternal twins, obviously, but they were so different, and that's the comedy line of the movie. So why stop at twins? You can actually have more. You know, sometimes nature will provide. Very rare. Twins are about 1 in 100. Triplets are about 1 in 100 and 100, which is about 1 in 10,000 births. Okay, very rare. But if you go to IVF, in vitro fertilization, what happens is that the embryos are collected. Okay, the eggs are collected. They're put with the sperm. They become fertilized. They start forming a marula. And then the physician, with your consent, can put in one or two or three or four or five. It used to be. These days, I think there are limits. I think in America it's two. But in the beginning, this procedure wasn't that great. And if you put in four or five, you might get one that survived. And so people would put in 4 or 5 or 6 or in this case, 7. And so this lady had 7 children. So she had a little girl, tried to have kids. She and her husband tried to have kids. They couldn't. And so they went to the doctor. They did this implantation, and they had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 little babies. So, of course, the human uterus cannot carry 7 babies, and so this was a very premature birth. But why stop at 7? Right? Let's go to 8. Okay? Nadia Suleiman, remember her? Octomom. 8 children. And so she gave birth, I think, at 24 weeks to 25 weeks. This is early pregnancy, relatively. You can see how huge her belly is. I mean, it's just, you just can't carry 8 kids. But she did. And with a lot of medical care, those kids survived. And she now has 8 children. So one of the limitations, then, is the availability of nutrients. And so how do we establish a connection with the mama? Okay? Because you're inside your mother's belly, right? You're inside the womb, and you've got to grow. And so you need stuff. You need oxygen. You need glucose. You need amino acids. And so the way this is done is through the formation of the placenta. And you can see that the placenta normally, and this is close to term, would be on one side of the uterus. Here it is there. And if you look closely, you can see that there's the umbilical cord here, which is composed of 2 umbilical arteries. And these arteries come down. One starts from each side of the leg of the fetus. I think it's a hypogastric artery, maybe, that it comes off of. And they kind of twine their way down in the umbilical cord to the placenta, spread out over the surface of the placenta, and then dive down into the placenta to form what's called the fetal villi, which are these structures. And then the blood comes back and forms the one umbilical vein, shown in red because it's oxygenated blood, and that vein returns the blood back to the fetus. And so essentially then, there's no mixing of the blood. It's not that we're getting the mother's blood. It's that we have these villi, which are bathed in the mother's blood, and everything happens across the wall of the villus. And so this is a nice drawing that shows you the structure of a human placenta as well. And notice here, again, we have the umbilical arteries, these 2 vessels. They kind of spread over the surface of the placenta. This is called the chorionic plate. This is the basal plate. And so these arteries that if you just follow one, you know, it goes down here, there, and it branches down to here, and it goes all the way down to the tip of this villus, turns around, comes back into the umbilical vein, and returns to the fetus. And so this purple space is the space that they're dangling in, that they're going to be bathed in the mother's blood in. So what they show in this slide is they show the spiral arteries of the mother here are now attached to the placenta, and the mother's blood flows into the intervillous space, which is this purple space, fills it with blood, and so blood comes in and the blood goes out, and this provides a constant supply of nutrients and gases and carries away wastes and gases like CO2, all the exchange has to occur across the villus wall. And so if you look at a cross-section of a villus, it's lined by trophoblast cells. If you think of it as a finger, the skin would kind of be the trophoblast cells. And inside, you'd have a fetal capillary. This is really the same capillary. It's just if you followed it down, you know, to the end of the villus, it would turn around and come back up. So we see it now in cross-section on its return as well. So for something like a molecule of oxygen to go from the fetus to the mother, I'm sorry, mother to the fetus, would have to go from right here, mother's blood, across the trophoblast, across the fetal endothelium into the fetal blood. Likewise, a molecule of CO2 would have to pass across the endothelium and across the trophoblast cells and pass into the mother's blood. So the active principle here really is a trophoblast cell. The fetal endothelium is kind of a dumb cell. It's there, it does its job, but it doesn't control the passage of things. But the trophoblast cell does. And so the way things pass across the placenta depends on what the thing is. And so some things like oxygen and CO2 diffuse readily, no problem at all. They go back and forth depending on concentration gradients. So the CO2 levels are higher in the fetal blood, so the CO2 will diffuse out of there into the mother's blood. Likewise, oxygen will diffuse into the fetal blood from the mother's blood. Some things like glucose are transferred by facilitated diffusion, meaning there are carriers in those trophoblast cells, also concentration dependent, but you need a carrier to actually ferry that molecule into and across the cell. Some things get across by simple diffusion. Some things get taken up by phagocytosis, some by active transport. So it's very much like the gut. If you had the gut, you have, right? Very much like the villi of the gut. The same path, the same physiological processes are at play. And so notice here it says hormones, some. Well, some hormones get across. The ones that are lipophilic get across nicely, but the ones that are polar, like insulin, really don't get across very well. And this goes both for hormones in the fetal blood and hormones in the maternal blood. Antibodies will come across. Some drugs will come across. Some viruses will come across. Some won't. So, for example, HIV is a retrovirus. It doesn't pass across the placenta. And so if a child becomes infected with HIV, normally it's by exposure to the mother's blood during the process of birth. Okay, I think that's kind of just covers it. I mean, you could teach a whole course on placental exchange, but if you think about it, I guess the message I'd like you to, or the image I'd like you to have, is that the placenta is a chamber. It's got a chorionic plate, a roof, basal plate, floor. There would be, if this room was a placenta, there would be 30 to 50 openings through which the mother's blood would be entering. I couldn't see you, and I couldn't see you because the villi would be in the way, okay? And the mother's blood would come in and then leave through venules. The baby's blood would come down from the chorionic plate into the villi, circulate, and leave, and go back up into the umbilical cord. So no mixing of the blood. But nature isn't perfect, and there's always a few villi that rupture, and there's always a little bit of bleeding that happens, okay? And so up until recently, it was very difficult to find, to isolate the fetal cell. But with the newer techniques, people do it routinely now, and there's a new way of screening genetically that involves just a blood sample from the mom, as opposed to the previous techniques, which were amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling. And so we'll talk about that. But the placenta is a very active endocrine organ. It makes HCG early on, even the blastocysts already making HCG. Remember, that's the LH-like molecule that is secreted in order to keep the corpus luteum going. And so you don't want menstruation to occur. The way you prevent menstruation is you keep progesterone and estrogen levels high so that the endometrium is happy. And so this little, you know, pinprick of life, okay, this little tiny, tiny little thing is already thinking about its own survival, even though it doesn't have a brain, and it's secreting something that's going to keep it alive by preventing the mother's menstruation. And so this gives you a clue to the fact that there's a lot of signaling that goes on from the embryo and fetus to the mother. And those signals, molecular signals, include HCG, estrogen, progesterone, HPL, prolactin, relaxin, probably 50 other hormones. I mean, it's an incredible generator of signals. And so if you think about it, it's nice that the corpus luteum is there. It's nice that the corpus luteum can be kept alive by secreting HCG. But ultimately, the corpus luteum is fairly small, and the levels of progesterone and estrogen increase throughout pregnancy. They become quite high. And so it'd be better if the fetus could make the estrogen and progesterone, right? And so it does. And roughly then, around day 50 of pregnancy, about 7 weeks into pregnancy, the need for the corpus luteum is not there anymore because the estrogen and progesterone is now being made by the placenta. And so this passage of estrogen, progesterone primarily being derived from the corpus luteum and now being derived primarily from the placenta is called the luteo-placental shift around day 50 of pregnancy. And so now if a woman, you know, God forbid, has ovarian cancer, she has to have her ovaries taken out, after about 2 months, she can have the ovaries taken out because the ovaries aren't doing anything anymore. It's all on autopilot with the placenta at that point. So a word about our Wiley chromosomes. Our chromosomes, we have, as you know, 46 chromosomes. Here's a picture of the Y chromosome and the X chromosome. You can see how small the Y chromosome is. And there are aberrations sometimes where during the process of meiosis, instead of the copies of the chromosome separating, maybe both copies go into one side, in which case, if that is the sperm that fertilizes the egg, with the maternal copy, there's going to be now three copies, right? That's a trisomy. Sometimes both go into one side, and it's the other side of that particular chromosome, that sperm maybe fertilizes the egg. In that case, it's only going to have a mother's copy. That's going to be a monosomy. So one of the most common trisomies is Down syndrome, a trisomy of the 21st chromosome. You can see that here circled, that there are three copies, not two, of that chromosome. Down's children look like this. You've all seen Down's kids. They usually have some experience, some stunted somatic growth. They usually have a lower intelligence, but they're very sweet, wonderful people. And so people have to decide if you have a Down's child, and the chances of having a Down's child increases with age, maternal age. So you have to decide whether you want to have a child, if it's going to have a chromosomal abnormality. So Down's, I think, is something that people can think about and deal with. But if you have a child that has some kind of chromosomal abnormality that will lead to most certainly dying by the age of 3, let's say, what do you do? And we had a doctor in our group a couple of years ago who was very religious. And so he and his wife had a child like this, and they were against abortion, and they had the child, and the child died after 6 months. So, you know, difficult, difficult decisions for people. So if you want to understand what the chromosomal profile is of the child, you have to get some cells that have those chromosomes. And so the older method is called amniocentesis. It involved passing a needle through the abdomen using ultrasound as guidance so you don't poke the fetus, drawing out some fluid, you know, not trivial, maybe 15 mils of fluid, spinning that fluid down. And because the fetus is floating around in that fluid and cells are sloughing off of it and is burping and so on, there's always cells that are in that fluid. And so you centrifuge those cells down, all fetal cells, you can do a chromosomal smear and see what the chromosomes look like. Then about 20 years ago, or 25 years ago, I think, early 90s, I believe it was, or mid-80s, this other technique called chorionic villus sampling, like CVS, like the drugstore, was used. And this involved passing a catheter through the vagina into the uterus via the cervix. And this catheter would just be a little biopsy catheter. It would snip off a little bit of the placenta. And remember, the placenta is all fetal, right? So if you get a little bit of placenta, you can get a little bit of the fetal cells and do an analysis. There were some abnormalities, birth defects that were associated with this procedure early on. So not perfect. And even amniocentesis, which is done, can carry its risk. Right? It can damage the fetus and so on. So usually amniocentesis was not recommended until a woman is about 35 years old. And the reason is that at the age of 35, the danger of the procedure is roughly 1 in 750 times something goes wrong, matched the likelihood of having a child with Down syndrome, about 1 in 750. And so when those two statistical lines crossed, that's when that procedure was recommended. But although both techniques are still in use, as of last year, genetic screening can now be performed on a sample of the mother's blood by isolating and sequencing fetal DNA. And I think this simple blood test will really soon replace both amniocentesis and CVS as routine screening for fetal chromosomal abnormalities. And this is done here in the hospital now. There are different companies that make it. It screened only for trisomy 21. Now it also screens for trisomy 18 and some other things. I think every year there's going to be more additional options with this. Marketed by several companies. Impressively low false positive rate, because you don't want a false positive, do you? You don't want someone telling you you've got a child with a chromosomal abnormality when that's really not the case. That's the thing you fear. A very low false positive, less than 1%. Sometimes combined with other tests to evaluate the fetus. And currently used, I think I put the wrong file in this morning without my coffee. It should be UVM Medical Center, of course, not Fletcher Allen. But it costs about $700, most of which is covered by insurance. So let me just take 1 second here, folks, because I'm realizing that this does not have some of the pictures I wanted to have. Good enough. It'll have to do. So anyway, so as we understand chromosomes, we've come to appreciate how many diseases are linked to chromosomal abnormalities, right? So this is just a slide that kind of shows you a fan of the chromosome pairs and then the various diseases that are associated with each chromosome. And you can see, for example, we talk about Down syndrome. Sure enough, on chromosome 21, Down syndrome, see chromosome 21. And so, and all the Tay-Sachs disease, Alzheimer's, I mean, all these diseases It doesn't mean that the disease is caused by that chromosome always. It means that in some cases of the disease, there are mutations in the chromosome that occur in people who have this disease. And so, for example, a difficult cancer like pancreatic cancer, I lost my mom and my grandmother both pancreatic cancer. There are some genes that are associated, mutations are associated with pancreatic cancer, 10 genes maybe. And so you can get tested for having those mutations, but you can still get pancreatic cancer without those mutations. So it's not, you know, it's not a black and white. It's just another bit of information that can be useful. Okay, so let's talk about now the process of pregnancy. This is, I think, a very beautiful photograph of Demi Moore pregnant with her first child. And you can see that she's pregnant because she has a belly, obviously, increased abdominal volume. But there are things that are going on in her body that you also can't see. And so when we think about some of the things that are going on, there are endocrine things, there are adaptations to the vascular system, to the heart, to many things. And we'll talk about some of this in generations. We'll talk about this again in third-year lectures during the OBGYN clerkship. But for today, let's keep it very simple and just kind of point to what happens during pregnancy. The endocrinology of pregnancy is simpler even than the endocrinology of the male, in that what happens is you have this increase in HCG, luteal placental shift, decrease in HCG. The corpus luteum is still there, still putting out estrogen, progesterone right through pregnancy. But you can see the levels are small compared to these levels, which are now coming from the placenta. And so estrogen and progesterone both increase progressively during pregnancy. And then shortly before birth, their relative concentrations begin to change. More so in animals than in humans, but generally there's an increase in the ratio of estrogen to progesterone as a person approaches the time of birth. And what this does, then, it kind of leads to a balance or changes the balance from being peaceful progesterone primarily to now being exciting estrogen, and so things start getting exciting. And so you have contractions. People can have contractions anytime during pregnancy, but these are normally mild, okay, infrequent, intermittent Braxton Hicks contractions. But once a woman begins to approach the moment of giving birth, then she will have to undergo much more vigorous, much more rhythmic and forceful contractions. And that's the beginning of labor. And so this drop in estrogen and progesterone is one thing that may contribute to it. There are other things as well, and you'll see those in a minute. But staying with the adaptation idea first, these are some of the major things that happen during pregnancy. Okay, there's an increase in plasma volume. A woman's volume of blood will increase 40-50% when she's pregnant, presumably to have more blood in case she loses some blood, which she most certainly will during the process of birth. She also has increased red blood cells, but they don't quite keep up with the increase in the fluid portion of the blood, the plasma, and so the hematocrit tends to drop a little bit. So if a person is anemic and they become pregnant, that drop, maybe 4 or 5 points in hematocrit, may push a person into being symptomatic, dizzy, tired, and so on. Increased cardiac output, the heart pumps more forcefully with each contraction. It pumps more frequently. So the pulse increases by 10 or 15 beats per minute. Doesn't sound like an awful lot, I mean, it's significant, but if you think about it, that's roughly 14,000 extra beats per day. So that's a lot more work for our poor little heart to do. And so if you have heart disease, you have a heart problem, sometimes this becomes unmasked during pregnancy. Blood pressure doesn't really change. Usually it kind of goes down, U-shaped curve, goes down, and then kind of goes up. There are hormonal things like an activation of renin and angiotensin, the increase in estrogen and progesterone. And finally, in the third trimester in particular, you're breathing for two. So you have to breathe more, generally more deeply. So there's an increase in the minute volume. So these are some of the maternal adaptations that occur. And as you can imagine, as the uterus grows, it increases in size. And so this shows you kind of where the top of the uterus might be as a function of gestational age. And this female has, let's say, a baby. And here we have 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, 9 months. And then right around birth, because there's a laxity in the pelvic ligaments, there's a loosening of sorts of connective tissue. And so you notice it shows you here that that there's a slight drop here, okay, dropping in preparation for delivery. And then eventually, of course, the child would be completely expelled. So looking at it from a, I always forget these terms, sagittal, is it sagittal view? Yeah, okay, sagittal view, thank you. You can see that a term, here's a non-pregnant woman, she has lots of GI system here, liver and so on, bladder, right? But here, in this case, in the late pregnant female, you have the child here, really occupying a lot of space. And so the skin has to stretch, of course, to accommodate, to increase the abdominal volume. And so now we have the progression of human embryonic and fetal growth. And this is a couple things about this slide are worth noting. First, fertilization, then conceptus is often used for the first couple of weeks. And then from 3 weeks to about 9 weeks, the term embryo is used, 8 weeks. And then by 9 weeks, we start calling it a fetus. And so at this point, the fetus is very small. I don't remember the exact size, but I think at 9 weeks, the fetus is like half an inch or something. It's still quite small. But remarkably, already, all the major organ systems have been laid down. And so there is a heart. There are lungs and so on. And then we have the growth of the fetus throughout the remainder of pregnancy. Okay, so here you saw this tip of a pin, Morula. At 3 weeks, we have the strange-looking creature that we were. Not sure where the head, I think it's the head and the tail, but hard to tell. And boy, we sure do grow a tail, don't we? Look at that, by about 4 weeks. And the head forms, and then roughly by about 6 weeks or so, you can see what looks beginning to look like an embryo. You can see the eyes, and you can see the umbilical cord beginning to form. But at this point, the placenta, and you can just see it in this lower left corner, a little bit of it, the placenta is much bigger than the embryo. So early in pregnancy, a lot of energy is put into the process of placentation. And establishing that process is very important, because if it's not established correctly, then there's not going to be enough blood coming into the placenta, which means not being enough nutrients and gases coming to the fetus, which leads to a condition called placental ischemia or placental underperfusion. And one of the most common diseases of pregnancy, preeclampsia, is thought to begin because of this early underperfusion of the placenta. So here is the placenta early on, very pinnate, very feathery, absorbing, doing what it should be doing. This is what we looked like when we were about maybe 7 weeks old, kind of alien-looking creatures that we were, with a furrowed brow and nose forming, mouth forming. And then we have the yolk sac, and we have the placenta. Again, see how big it is here, the embryo floating. This is about maybe 7 weeks. This is probably about 10 or 11 weeks. Notice that the eyes have closed. Interestingly, the eyes are open for about the first 9 weeks, and then they close. And they stay closed until the seventh month, and then they open again. So here you can see the eyes are closed. You can see the very beautiful picture of the amniotic fluid. You see the umbilical cord. You can see the placenta. This is a little later in life. You can see the, again, remarkable photographs, the umbilical cord. Here's the placenta. Here's that chorionic plate with these vessels ramifying along its surface. The fetus begins to move. It will suck its thumb. You can see the cartilage and the bones forming in the hands in this picture. And then this is about 16 weeks or so. Notice how large the head is relative to the body. So the head becomes very large early on. And this is about a 20-week fetus. This is about a 7-month-old fetus. Now, notice the placenta is quite small compared to the fetus. It doesn't mean it's really small. It's about a pound. I mean, it's a good-sized structure. But proportionally, it becomes smaller. And then hopefully, at 9 months, you've got a baby. And so that's a healthy pregnancy. Luckily, about 90% of pregnancies are healthy pregnancies. And as we learn more and more, of course, we can do better and better. But I have to tell you that the baby doesn't look like this when they're born. And so, truly, this is kind of what they look like. I mean, it's tough being born. We've all been through it. Man, it's a tough thing. So anyway, you can all see this boy, the penis here. So this is going to be a male. And also the umbilical cord is here, right? Okay, so who decides when you're born? You do, probably, most primarily. And so the process of being born, parturition, is a long process, and it can last several days in humans. And it's kind of a conspiracy of influences that goes on. And so what you have is you have the production of estrogen, relaxin, and progesterone. You have changes in those hormones, although, like I said, it's not as dramatic in humans as it is in some animals. You've got fetal growth, which actually stretches the myometrium. Smooth muscles, when they become stretched, become depolarized. When muscle becomes depolarized, it tends to let calcium in. When it lets calcium in, it tends to contract, right? So just the physical stretching contributes to this. And then we also have an increased production of prostaglandins. We have the release of oxytocin from the posterior pituitary in the mom's head, brain. And so oxytocin tends to be a contractile hormone. That helps contract the uterus. And an increased excitability of the uterine musculature. So gap junctions form between the muscle cells, and they become more coordinated. And slowly you become a little more excitable, and then you have a contraction, then you'll have another contraction, and the contractions become more forceful and more frequent. And so the first stage of labor, which is the painful long stage, is the dilation stage, which means you have to produce enough force by the uterus to physically dilate the cervix, using basically the head of the child as a battering ram, if you will, to make the cervix bigger. Now, that's not quite true, because the child is in fluid, fetus in fluid, and so on. But really, it's the pressure that has to widen that cervix so that the head can pass through. Usually 9 centimeters is what's required. And that could take 24, 48, 72 hours. It could take a long time. If a woman's not having a forceful enough labor, she can be given oxytocin. Pitocin, I think, is the commercial name for it, to augment her contractions. And so once the cervix is dilated, then comes the second phase of labor, which is the expulsion phase. So now the child can be squeezed out of the uterus. And so this shows you some of the events that occur. Here's a woman laying on her back. Now, this person, most times birth still occurs with the female on her back. But sometimes the Indians, they squat. It kind of makes more sense in a way. It seems to make more sense. Gravity, I don't know. But really, it's a person's choice. And so here is the dilation, breaking of the water, the expulsion phase. And finally, we have the placenta that's still inside, remember? So the placenta should separate from the wall of the uterus, and usually does, and be expelled also in about maybe anywhere from 20 minutes to maybe an hour. And so if it's not expelled, then that's a problem, because you can have infection, ascending infection. At the same time, you don't want to pull on the cord and yank the placenta out either, because you can cause a lot of bleeding. So like most animals, when you give birth, like a horse gives birth, it doesn't reach around and pull the umbilical cord out of its body. It just waits, and sure enough, the placenta normally then comes out. Once a child is born, the child should be fed. So you can choose to breastfeed, or you can choose to bottle feed through commercial milk. The breast is very nicely suited for feeding the young, because we have these alveoli that we talked about, the ducts that converge on the nipple. And the alveoli are lined with very synthetic cells. And so the production of milk entails taking fluids and taking nutrients out of the capillaries into these cells. Notice all the rough endoplasmic reticulum, then forming lipids and proteins and fluid and so on, and secreting them into the lumen of the alveolus. And now once that milk is there, if a child wants to drink, there's a reflex which allows that milk to be squeezed out and delivered to the child. And so that's called the milk letdown reflex. It involves receptors in the nipple being stimulated by the suckling of the child. This then stimulates nerve impulses to go up the spinal cord into the brain, stimulation of hypothalamic nuclei. Posterior lobe of the pituitary, which really is an outgrowth of the hypothalamus, releases oxytocin. Oxytocin contracts myoid cells, which are smooth muscle-type cells, which are wrapped around the alveoli. So these cells contract, they squeeze the alveoli, milk let down. At first, the milk is very rich and very yellowish in color. It's called colostrum. If a woman chooses not to breastfeed, if she can just breastfeed for a couple of days, that's good, because there's a lot of antibodies and so on that are transferred to the child in the colostrum. But as you can see in this picture, as time goes by, the milk becomes more watery and more white. And so as we learn more about breastfeeding, we understand that actually has a lot of beneficial effects. And so milk contains several components that have immunobeneficial effects, like immunoglobulins, antibacterial, antiviral factors, cytokines, immune cells. And some of the benefits of breastfeeding to the infant are immunologic, better GI health, reduced incidence of some diseases later in life, a reduced incidence of SIDS, and some possible cognitive benefits. Some benefits of breastfeeding to the mother are that breastfeeding stimulates metabolism, promotes uterine involution after birth. It reduces the risk of postpartum hemorrhage. It lowers the risk of ovarian and breast cancer later in life. It facilitates a return to pre-pregnancy weight through the metabolic stimulation. It may decrease the risk of postmenopausal osteoporosis. Interesting, huh? What you do when you're 22 years old, maybe, you know, or 18 years old, or 30 years old, have a child, breastfeed, don't breastfeed, will affect how healthy you'll be when you're 70 years old. And this is a burgeoning field of research that's called fetal programming. And it just, the more people look, the more they're amazed at how much in utero life impacts adult life. Also, the process of breastfeeding increases the bonding with the infant. And this is thought to be carried out partly through oxytocin, which is a very intriguing hormone. It's produced in the posterior pituitary, it binds to a G-protein coupled receptor, it mediates the milk let-down reflex, like we just said, stimulates uterine contractility, and it plays a role in maternal-infant bonding. So I think if our little world would pass through the celestial, like, cloud of oxytocin, it would come out a better world, because oxytocin makes people more centered, makes people appreciate other people more, makes people more tolerant. It's released when you hug somebody. It's released when you make love. You know, it's a wonderful hormone. And I think our world certainly can use it. Some disorders of pregnancy. Ectopic pregnancy occurs when implantation occurs not in the uterus, but in most often in the fallopian tube. That really can't be sustained. Preeclampsia, also called toxemia of pregnancy, the older term, is a form of hypertension that develops during pregnancy. It's characterized by hypertension, proteinuria. You'll have a lecture on this in Generations. Abruptio placentae is a separation of the placenta before birth, which can be mild or it can be severe. If there's a lot of the placenta that peels away from the uterine wall, you're going to have bleeding, you're going to lose the perfusion of the placenta, lose the ability to provide nutrients to the child and enter into a state of fetal distress. Okay, placenta previa, which is an implantation that occurs too low, and so when placentation occurs, the placenta will cover the cervix, and if that cervix is covered, of course, when you begin to undergo labor and the cervix begins to dilate, you can rip the placenta and disrupt it. That's a bad situation. And finally, gestational diabetes, which is a type 2 diabetes, which occurs in pregnancy. So the human sexual response, I don't say very much about it because, first of all, you can't do justice in 3 minutes. But, of course, it all starts with libido, right? Everyone has their own level of sex drive, and so that differs between people. It's still a mystery what really causes libido. But these are sex pills that you can buy at the sex museum in New York City. My wife and I went there, had to check it out, you know. No, not because of that. As a teacher, I needed to see what this is all about. Okay, so they, and I didn't buy any of these pills, but maybe I should have. But anyway, they contain some kind of goji berries or something that are supposed to stimulate libido, okay? So anyway, in humans, there are different ways to describe the sexual response. Masters and Johnson's way probably is still the most abiding way. Phase 1, desire, right? Phase 2, excitement. Phase 3, plateau. And then phase 4, orgasmic phase. And phase 5, resolution phase. So using this kind of a framework, people have drawn, in a very, I think, limited kind of way, have drawn the human sexual response. Here in a male, it shows you these phases, okay, excitement, plateau, orgasm. And so a man will become aroused. The arousal will be sustained for some time. And then if he ejaculates, he'll have an orgasm. And then there's a refractory period where he cannot achieve another erection for some time. And then everything can start again. In the female, there can be several different patterns. So you can have a pattern similar to the male, arousal, and then plateau here, and then orgasm, and no orgasm, you know, close, not quite there, this one here, okay? Or you could have several orgasms. So it's more complicated because the female organism, I think, is more complicated on a physiological level. In the female, orgasm is not associated with fertility. And it's not something to laugh at, really. It's a serious thing that can be quite troubling to some people if they aren't able to achieve orgasm. So part of the stimulation that's important is the clitoral stimulation. This shows you the clitoris, the glands, and this shows you the whole clitoris. Remember I said about how this tissue is erectile tissue that passes on either side of the vaginal opening. And so we have the crust clitoris, the corpus cavernosum, just like in men, and the glans clitoris. And this is the organ that's the most sensitive to sexual stimulation. Okay, finally, in the last 10 minutes or so, aging and the human reproductive system and birth control. So puberty in children, you know, girls or boys, is not a process that occurs in a summer. It takes years, and it's a series of events that occur. And so in girls, you have the formation of breast buds, and I think I will use girls and boys here. I think it's appropriate. Girls, you have formation of breast buds, pubic hair, height spurt, menarche, which is the first menstrual period, growth of pubic hair and axillary hair, and the growth of the breasts. And so here you can see years, 8 to 20. I mean, hopefully it doesn't take that long, but it'll take a few years. It'll take the whole thing process may take 3-4 years. And so in boys, spermatogenesis begins. Again, the hypothalamus, remember the hypothalamus, GnRH, LHFSH, right? Those things start working on the gonads, the testes grow, the seminiferous tubules grow, spermatogenesis begins. And then pubic hair appears, height spurt, adult genitalia develop, and this boy will then become a man and go through puberty. And so some of the changes then are shown here, development of facial hair, musculature, broader shoulders, increased body hair, pubic hair, growth of the genital organs, and a more muscular body, primarily due to the androgens, the testosterone, which is now much higher than it was when you were a child. And so development of female characteristics, breasts, growth, redistribution of fat into more of a female appearance, and appearance of pubic hair and axillary hair. So aging, I found this picture. I thought it was interesting. And I thought, well, you know, people are always messing with us with images, you know. And so I thought, I wonder what this guy really looks like young and old. And so I photoshopped this. I came up with that, okay. So here's the younger man, and here's the older man. Very unhappy man. I think he's very unhappy because he's been wearing the same T-shirt for 60 years, you know. That can't be good, I don't think. So, but anyway, it's funny how they really draw this very differently, don't they, to convey a different thing. I mean, he doesn't have to be frowning as an old person. He could be smiling, but he's not, okay? So what happens to the hormone levels? Well, when you're a kid, you should run around, play with your friends, don't worry about the hormones. And that's what happens normally is there's very low levels of hormones because the hypothalamus is very, very sensitive. I mean, you do have ovaries if you're a female. You do have testes if you're male. But those very, very low levels of the sex steroids are enough to suppress the hypothalamus. And then somehow, for reasons we don't quite understand, around the time of puberty, hypothalamus wakes up and says, wait a minute. We need a little more testosterone in males, right? We need a little more estrogen, progesterone in females. So it starts putting out these pulses of GnRH, which activate the pituitary. The pituitary puts out the gonadotropins, which activate the gonads, and we have the process of puberty. And so in men, then, testosterone levels increase, and they slowly decrease over the years. Gonadotropins, because of the loss of negative feedback, tend to increase. Men have had children, I don't know why, but they have, at the age of 70 or 80. Everything's slower, it takes more time, but everything still kind of works. Okay, but so man, I mean, spermatogenesis still continues and so on. In females, it's more discreet. Again, low levels in childhood, the reproductive years, and then following menopause, which is really a process that takes several years. A woman's periods may become irregular, heavy or lighter, you know, change, and eventually she stops menstruating, and that represents the loss of the ability to naturally have a child. And so menopause occurs roughly around the age of 50. People on birth control pills don't have any change in the age of menopause. It doesn't seem to really affect the age of menopause at all. So it's kind of a built-in atresia that we talked about in terms of follicles. And so in terms of birth control, some commonly used methods are barrier methods, such as condoms, hormonal methods, such as pills, patches, rings, and some of these hormonal methods, which are long-acting birth control, are very effective and become very popular now. Fertility awareness, not planning, planning, and planning, okay? You can plan, but it carries some risk. Rhythm method. IUDs, also a very nice form birth control. These are little devices that are put into the uterus. They irritate the lining of the uterus. Some, like the Mirena, is impregnated with steroids. And it's a very effective method of birth control. And once they're removed, a woman becomes fertile very quickly. And finally, sterilization in men, vasectomy, and women, tubal ligation, is the most effective way. And so if you look at the failure rate of these various methods, well, you know, no birth control is not 100% failure because you don't always get pregnant, but you probably have a good chance of getting pregnant if you don't use any birth control. But then we have things like the scap, the sponge, spermicides, female condom, abstinence, withdrawal, diaphragm, male condom, oral contraceptives. And really the best things are tubal ligation, vasectomy, and combined oral contraceptives, which are about 99-point-something% effective. So very effective methods of contraception. And I should point out that this is an ad from the Planned Parenthood, which is kind of under siege in our country at this point by some people. But this was an ad that was back in the 60s, and I remember this ad, and it was it said, "Would you be more careful if it was you that got pregnant?" And so men, you know, a woman doesn't get pregnant by herself. We need to take responsibility for our actions. And unfortunately, many men do not. So I'm sure you all will, but, you know, some people won't. And so finally, surgical sterilization is probably the best way. This shows you the vasectomy, where a section of the vas is taken out. It can often be reconnected, although not with 100% certainty. If you life changes and you have a child, you know, you had your children and your wife dies, you get remarried, who knows, right? You never know what life's going to bring for you. But you can't assume you're going to be able to be fertile again. But you can assume that if you have a vasectomy, that you're going to be infertile. And similarly with the oviduct, interruption of the oviduct, of course, will prevent any eggs from coming down into the uterus, and so you'll be 100% sterile. Of course, if your doctor is a good doctor, he or she will do it on both sides. So this wouldn't be a great procedure. This would be a great procedure. You know, you got to do this one here, and this one here as well. All right, folks. Well, I think that's it. Thank you very much. You guys have been a good class. Appreciate the time. Hope you understand it all. And if you need any help, just email me. If you want to get together, happy to get together with you. Thank you. Hi there. Good, let me turn this off.